Hello and welcome to The Uplift. I'm Robert Ashley, and we thank you once again for being with us here on The Uplift. We're going to be with you on Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 12 noon right here on The Uplift. As a matter of fact, you can listen to The Uplift Network 24/7. And of course, that's 24/7, and we encourage you to do just that. Well, today we do have a distinct privilege of having a very interesting, very distinguished sitting judge with us today. And for many of you, hopefully, if you ever have to go before a judge, you'll get a chance to go before a fair judge. As a matter of fact, as we're coming on, there was some breaking news. Speaking of the judicial system, we had learned that Bill Cosby, who had been convicted, as a matter of fact, that whole trial involving Bill Cosby has indeed been overturned. There was a judge who said that the conviction and the prosecution based that particular prosecution based upon bias. So sooner or later, Bill Cosby is going to be a free man. But with me at this time, a very distinguished judge by the name of Judge Amber Givens. And of course, we understand that Judge Givens is indeed a dedicated public servant. Now, she currently presides over the 282nd Judicial District Court right here in Dallas, Texas, in Dallas County. And before taking office, I understand, back in January 1st, 2015, Judge Givens served as an assistant district attorney in New York and in Texas for 8 years. And of course, Judge Givens also received her Bachelor of Arts degree in political science from a very distinguished university. How about Tuskegee? My goodness, when we think about those Tuskegee Airmen, the kind of courage, the kind of power that came from that university, if you will. It also earned her Juris Doctorate degree from another very distinguished university, Syracuse University College of Law. Now, of course, I could just go on here with Judge Givens because she has so much going on, and we're going to talk about some of the things that's going on with Judge Amber Givens. And first of all, Judge, it's an honor to be in your presence, and we thank you for your time. How are you today?
I'm doing well. I'm blessed. Thank you for having me today. I appreciate it.
Well, it's an honor speaking with a very distinguished judge as yourself. Now, first of all, are you up for re-election or being a sitting judge? How does that whole scenario works in terms of the election process?
So my term is 4 years. So you run for office every 2 years. So it is. It's election season for me now.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah. Have you drawn any opponents yet?
I'm not aware of any official opponents, so we are rocking and rolling. But every election cycle, this will be my third term. And so every election cycle, I owe the residents of Dallas County to show up. And so even if I don't draw an opponent, just like my last election cycle, I was still out here working, because you should always earn the people's support and never just get relaxed. So regardless, I'll be out here. You'll see me in these streets.
Beautiful. Now, do you need to collect signatures? What do you have to do to make sure that you're on the ballot?
Yes. So in Dallas County, and it's different in every county, in Dallas County, you need 750 signatures to get on the ballot, unless you want to spend money. And, you know, I'm earning you all support again. And in doing that, I need fundraising. So I try not to use, I've never paid to get on the ballot. So I don't use the hard-earned money of those that support me to pay to get on the ballot. Instead, I go out, I'm in the streets, I am working to get the signatures. So I'll be getting 750, which for me means I'm really going to get like 5,000 signatures.
Yes, it did. Now, is that going to be challenging in this COVID-19 environment?
You know, so far it hasn't been. I thought that, and you know, the world is really open back up now. And so I have a number of volunteers that are getting signatures for me.
Beautiful, beautiful. Now, also, we understand a kickoff campaign event that's coming up in the very near future, art competition.
Yes. You know, so I think this last year has been so challenging, but it's also been one that has reminded us of our strength. And so I wanted my kickoff to be a celebration of our expression as a community. So not just a come eat with me, have some beverages with me, but an actual experience. So it's an equitable justice themed art competition and campaign kickoff. And so I'm excited about it. We have a number of very talented artists that are participating, and I can't wait to see what they think equitable justice looks like, you know, so how they express that. And so far I've been blown away. That's one thing I wish I could do. I'm not an artist. So I'm really impressed with our local artists here in the DFW area. And so people should come out there. It won't just be the art, but of course, the thoughtful art expressions are, you know, key. There'll be live entertainment, including live graffiti artist DJ Tasia from K104. Yes. Actually, one of my close friends, Lady Jade, is hosting.
Beautiful.
And so it's just going to be fun. We're going to have food. We're going to, you know, there'll be vendors. So if you want to spend some money, you know, you've been cooped up in the house, it could be even a really nice date night.
Beautiful. Now, where can people find out more information about this?
So they can go to www.ambergivens.com/events. And the description of the event is there. Tickets are $30. And the event will be at Lofty Spaces at 816 Montgomery Avenue. Montgomery Street, and parking is free, and just come have a good time with me from 7 to 9 on Tuesday, July 13th.
All right. Well, once again, if you're just now tuning in, you're listening to the Uplift Network. I'm Robert Ashley, and today we have the honor of speaking with a very distinguished judge. We're talking here with Judge Amber Givens, and of course, she currently presides over the 282nd Judicial District Court right here in Dallas County. And Judge Givens, now your court, criminal, felony court, tell us about your court.
Yes. So I preside over a felony court. It is a criminal caseload, and I preside over everything from enhanced theft cases to capital murder cases. And so anything from your enhanced theft to robberies or assaults of any sort. And so a wide array of cases.
Yes. Now, before we get into some of the programs that you're doing, and a little bit more about your background and some of the concerns that you have as a sitting judge to make sure that justice is being administered, as you were attending Tuskegee and Syracuse, did you know you want to be a judge, or where did the judicial aspirations come from?
I had no idea. I think one of the very key things about attending Tuskegee is that it taught us that education really is, once you get in education, a higher education, you owe the community, right? So it's not just about you walking away with a degree. It's about you serving. And so that was one thing that they instilled in us from moment one and walking on the campus. And so understanding that service was key to me, I went to the DA's office first because I think that's where all the power is, right? That's where all the discretion is. You get to decide who should be charged, why should they be charged, what offer, if any, to make. And so I never thought I would leave the DA's office. Mm-hmm. But as a prosecutor, I did witness some things that were happening in a specific court. And I'm from St. Louis, so, you know, the show me state, Missouri. If you see something, say something, right? And so I was uniquely positioned to see that there were things that needed to be fixed in this specific courtroom. And so how do you fix things? I decided to run for office. And so to make sure that the cases were being handled in a timely, efficient, and fair manner for everyone, regardless of, you know, what you look like, your socioeconomic background, who you could afford to pay to represent you in court, because those things shouldn't matter.
Beautiful. Well, it sounds like you have some of the old civil rights flavor of giving back, whereas a lot of people now go to college, make a lot of money, and just, get caught up in self-aggrandizement. But it seems like you have that commitment of giving back, and that's a real unique quality.
Thank you.
But Judge Givens also, real quickly now, because you got a lot here, the AmeriCorps National Civilian Community Corps. You were involved with that?
I was. So after I graduated from Tuskegee, I told you they taught us about service.
Yes.
So after I graduated, I didn't go straight to law school. I took 11 months off and actually served in AmeriCorps. I made about $1.02 an hour. And I worked probably an 80-plus hour work week.
Yeah.
And so I actually essentially volunteered at an elementary school called Adams Elementary School in St. Louis. And I did everything from teaching I decided it's never enough to just do your 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. I feel like wherever you are, wherever you're getting, even if it's just $1.02 an hour, wherever you're getting that money from, you owe them more than just to show up every day. So I created a student government association. So it was so cute. We had the little kindergartners. They were, you know, campaigning to become the senator for their class.
Yes.
So in each grade level, we had a senator. They actually volunteered in the community. They did things with the seniors in the area, and they actually organized a healthcare fair, because a lot of people in that area can't afford, didn't have insurance, and so they needed screenings and things like that. So that was one of the things, and then the cheerleading squad. So I was with my little girls every day, teaching them about discipline without them even knowing that that's what I was doing, and going to the basketball games on the weekend. So that was my year, my gap year between Tuskegee and Syracuse.
My goodness. So you were really in the vineyard. As the Bible says, you went in the vineyard and actually were doing some working. So that is indeed powerful, Judge, powerful. Real quickly also, now we also understand that you were involved with the Oak Cliff Boys and Girls Club, the Dallas County Juvenile Board, the advisory board for the Dallas Women's Lawyers Association. And you also distinguished yourself. You was elected by the Texas Bar Foundation as a very, very young fellow, we understand. How do you achieve such success?
You know, I think when God creates the pathway for you, then, you know, as you step along the way, you just know you're headed in the right direction. So for me, it isn't even about awards, right? It's not about that at all. For me, it's about really leaving this place better than I found it, right? And so whatever I have to do to make sure that I'm changing the community and the landscape for the better, that's my goal.
Beautiful. Well, I'll tell you what, you've got so many accolades I could go on here, but once again, we're talking here with Judge Amber Gibbons, the presiding judge of the 282nd Judicial District Court right here in Dallas County. Of course, it's a criminal felony court, and boy, when people stand before you, they're facing some serious, serious situations. I mean, what kind of cases have you handled?
Murder cases of all sorts. You know, the one case in 2019 that I received all the attention for, surprisingly, just because of my hairstyle. I think in that, the good thing that came out of that is really society has marginalized certain people and decided that you don't fit in, you know, there's no space for you here. And I've received so many letters, so many cards, actually gifts from people that just told me, seeing me on the bench as myself each day and not worried about being, you know, about conforming to anyone's ideals of what beauty looks like or how my hair should be, really inspired them. And so for me, that meant a lot, coming from St. Louis, Missouri, and, you know, having the personal background that I have to now be on the bench, it means a lot.
Now, you wouldn't consider yourself a judicial radical now, would you?
I wouldn't. Others might, but no. I wouldn't. I would say that, you know, I think just because of my background, people might think that, you know, in just looking at me, you know, there have been many instances where people came into the courtroom. I'm sitting on the bench before the world shut down with my robe on, and they're like, "Where's the judge?" You know, because there's a look that society thinks, know, so yeah, not a radical, but I do think my life experiences have shaped me as a person, obviously. And I think it's made me more aware. I've had, you know, family members that have gone to the penitentiary and been a part of the system and witnessed that at a very young age. And I'm from St. Louis, and, you know, I think before Mike Brown, a lot of people didn't know us, maybe for the barbecue, maybe for Nelly and the St. Lunatics, right? But other than that, people weren't really paying attention. Right. And then the Mike Brown murder occurred, and it put us on the map for a very sad reason. And so coming from that space and actually being a part of the desegregation program myself in high school, right? We called it deseg, and it wasn't until I said it when I got to New York, people were like, desegregation? I was like, yeah, sure, for desegregation. I was a part of the program, right? So I think that shapes you because your life experiences do, and it's just made me more aware, so I'm not out of touch. When I see family members, mothers email me all the time and say, you know, Judge, I really felt like watching you in court. I come every time my son or daughter's case is set. I felt like I could approach you because you don't seem like you were just like, you know, here to do a job. You're here to make a difference. And so that means a lot to me because my mother was once that person, right? And so that every day, I think, is what drives me to get up in the morning to do what I do.
Beautiful, beautiful. And also, going back to the hairstyle. Now, that was an Anglo woman. Or I don't know if she was Anglo or Latin American, but she was not a black woman. She had shaved her hair as well. And some people compared the two of you and how the media treated you in terms of the reaction to the shaving of the hair. But your hairstyle, and what were you saying with that hairstyle and how you were treated?
Yeah, so I actually think it was one of my colleagues, and it was, she dyes her hair. And there was a meme that, you know, gosh, people and the internet wins all the time.
Yes,
right. So, again, I never thought anything of it, honestly, you know. And it's funny, when the story hit, people were like, yeah, you know, people in Dallas are always talking about your hair and how they don't, either they like it because it's different or they don't like it because they don't think that it's appropriate. And I didn't know that people were having the conversations. In my world, if you don't say it to my face, it's unsaid. So I had no idea that it was a topic of conversation because mm-hmm. for me, my hair has always been a way that I express myself. Mm. And I just love, and I'm about to do it again in a couple weeks.
Yes.
I'm going to shave yes. both of the sides off in the back and get back to rocking my individual radical, air quotes, hairstyle. You know, come by and see me or see me on Facebook Live so you can watch it every day.
Well, you know, we're told that a woman's hair is her glory. And whatever you deem glorified in terms of your hair, however you want to adorn yourself, you have every right to do that. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, we allow society to define what beauty is. But beauty is in the eyes of the beholder. So we ain't mad at you, sister. And we say, ain't nobody mad but the devil. So
right.
go on and look how you want to look, whatever you feel, my sister. We encourage you to do just that. But once again, we're talking here with Judge Amber Gibbons, who resides right now at the, presides, I should say, the 282nd Judicial District Court here in Dallas County, a felony court, a very, very serious judge. Now, Judge, you have seen what many call a miscarriage of justice within the system. You've seen the two standards, or the dual standards of justice. And we understand that as a person, a judicial officer of the court, you were concerned about people obtaining good counsel, because some people say, well, what's the difference between an appointed counsel and a counsel you hire yourself, long as you have a counsel, or is there a difference?
Well, the Constitution states that everyone's entitled to legal representation, whether you can pay for the attorney or not. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think it's key for people to understand that some of the same attorneys that are on what we call the wheel are the same people that if we had yellow pages, right? If you flip to them, you'd see those same people. The only thing is they've agreed to pay or accept less payment from the county for people that can't afford counsel.
Yes.
So even though you're entitled to counsel, the Constitution also says that you don't get to pick if you can't pay.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's really important that judges oversee and make sure, you know, I think today people were watching Facebook Live, and, you know, there were comments. Actually, I received some messages about, you know, people being upset that attorneys seem like they, some today, maybe didn't appear for their clients on other dates. And so the way that I combat that, you know, we generate what we call an unset list. The computer system does it. So if there's no pass slip, meaning there's no future date, then the person would just sit there without a court date in jail or on bond or what have you.
Wow.
And so in my court, my assistant and I set them so that the person doesn't get lost in the system. And then an email is sent out to the attorney like, you all didn't appear. So we reset this to another day. And so I just think that the involvement of the judge in the day-to-day docket matters is really key, instead mm-hmm. of just, you know, kind of, oh, whatever you want to do, you know, because I don't want to make anybody mad. And it's really important because people are cloaked in the presumption of innocence, whether it doesn't matter what the offense is that they're charged mm-hmm. with, they're still presumed innocent. So the idea that you would just let them sit without something happening is ludicrous to me.
Yes.
They have rights. And so, you know, people in the, as they say, the free world, they have to be concerned as if they're the ones in custody.
Yes.
They need to work on those cases as if it's their liberty at stake, because really it is, you know, and we've seen that in Dallas. Dallas has a lot of documented injustices. You know, unlike a lot of other places, Dallas kept the DNA in those older cases. We didn't have the science, but once the science caught up, you know, D.A. Watkins was very forward-thinking in how he handled creating the certain units, the conviction integrity unit, to make sure that he went back through those cases. Mm-hmm. And what we found out was there were a lot of people wrongly accused and convicted that spent decades of their lives for crimes that they didn't actually commit. And so I think, you know, it's really important that you have people on the bench that know that history and understand that, you know, the system does have flaws. If everybody doesn't do what they're supposed to do, and if everyone doesn't play their part, things fall through the cracks.
Sure.
And sure. So for me, that's just another reason why I love what I do every day, because it's the opportunity to make sure that, you know, people aren't taking pleas if they really aren't guilty. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times you hear people come back and they say, well, I just did it because my attorney told me to. And you can kind of, you can sense the hesitation even over Zoom. You know, when I'm asking the questions and they're like, oh, well, yeah, but they shrug their shoulder. So it's like the shrugging of the shoulder and the word yes, they just don't really jive. So yeah. What is it? You know, so I've busted a lot of pleas for that reason, because I want to, and I said this to myself, I want to sleep well every night. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go to sleep with something on my mind like, dang, I wish I had, or I wish I had asked the other question, mm-hmm. or I wish I hadn't just, you know, gone along with it just for the sake of doing so.
Yes.
So I said to myself always, I have to rest well, because I want to age well, right? So I have Amen. To rest well. So I think that's key. Sense.
Now another real quick question before I want, because I want to ask you about a couple of programs okay. that you have developed to help restore offenders. But we got a lot of talk now about bail reform. I know you're in a felony court, and it seems like a lot of the bail reform, I don't know if it deals with felony courts or just misdemeanor courts, but what do you think about all of this talk about bail reform? If somebody steals up to $750 worth of merchandise, then you know, our district attorney has come under fire. And just recently, I think Tarrant County District Attorney Sharon Wilson also announced same type of possible bail reform when it comes down to misdemeanors. But what do you think about this whole concept of bail reform? And I think Black Lives Matters have been concerned also about bail reform.
So I'll say this. Coming from New York, I started my legal career there. We actually had adversarial hearings regarding bail, so that the state made their position known, defense made their position known, and then the judge was equipped with the information necessary to make, you know, an accurate assessment of the case and what, if any, bond needed to be set. You know, got to Dallas, and things were, Texas overall, just different. There were no adversarial hearings. And I will say that the lawsuit is still pending, so I can't really get into details. The felony judges were removed from the lawsuit, yes. But I think what we know and what can't be denied is that reform is necessary.
Okay, thank you, Judge. Now, also, you are concerned about the people who come before your court, and you have developed several programs, from what we understand, have been really working well, helping to restore individuals. Can you tell us about the empowerment program? And then I'll ask you about the other program. But the empowerment program, what does that entail?
So when you're running for office, people ask you all the time, well, you know, what program are you going to implement? And I thought, a lot of times people answer out of candidate pride, right? Because you've never been a judge until you've been a judge.
Yes.
So I knew one thing for sure. I knew that I would work on and commit myself to having a very diverse grand jury, because the grand jury is so key. Mm-hmm. They decide who gets charged, right? And what I knew about Dallas was that in looking at the grand jury photos, the photos didn't look very diverse.
Exactly.
So I knew that I would be committed to getting a good cross-section of Dallas to participate in the grand jury process. So that's what I knew. And I was open to other programs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I sat on the bench. I was serving as a judge for maybe 6 months. And I was just, you know, taking note of things. And I realized there were so many people on felony probation that were failing. And it wasn't because they wanted to fail. It was because they just didn't have access to resources,
yes.
or they didn't believe in themselves, because society had told them, you know, you're bad. You have a criminal conviction. You know, you don't deserve a job. And it's like, how, you can't tell people to get a job mm-hmm. and then make it that much more difficult for them because they've made
right,
mistakes.
Right.
So I decided to identify people who were struggling on felony probation and just literally mentor them for, it started off as a 6 month program.
Mm-hmm.
It's now a 10-month program. I partnered them with actual mentors from the community, doctors, lawyers,
yes, yes.
accountants, what have you. And we walk through a 10-month program. And we start with very simple things that a lot of people take for granted.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go get a job. Well, if you live in Dallas and you don't have a license, how do you make that happen?
Right.
If you live in Dallas and, oh, go get a job, but you don't have a Social Security card, you never seen it before, your parents took it, did something with it, whatever. So we start with the basics.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Social Security Administration come in and help them get their replacement cards.
Beautiful.
We have DPS come in. And before the law changed, they would actually show my probationers how to get rid of those fees. You know, they were tacking on fees initially, yes, and the law changed. But they were helping them with that, telling them, pulling them up in the system literally to say, this is what you, this is what's going on with your record. This is what you need to take when you go to DPS. Because we all know it's frustrating to sit there for hours and then you get called, 1,999 was your number. You goodness. Finally get up to the window and you don't have what you need. My goodness. Right?
Start all over again.
Start all over. So we do things like that, and even etiquette training, mm-hmm. because when they get a job, I want them to excel at the job and it for it to become a career. So I don't want them to be worried about what fork to use beautiful. When they're at the table with their supervisor. Yes, yes. So we do stuff like that. And it's amazing to see the transformation because primarily they now believe in themselves.
Beautiful. And one other program that you started is called the Word of Mouth. Word of Mouth?
Word of Mouth. Yeah.
What's that all about?
So, you know, typically people find out information through word of mouth. Uh-huh. And a lot of times it's the wrong information. And so for me, I wanted to demystify the criminal justice system. And having been the family member of someone formerly incarcerated, mm-hmm. I figured what better way than to create just a series where we talk about these things, literally educating people before they ever need the information. Yes. Hopefully they'll never need the information, but educating them nonetheless. So we started with grand jury because it's so key. We've done a series session on, jury service. Mm-hmm. And in Dallas, I don't know if you all know this, but once upon a time, there was a manual used in Dallas that taught the prosecutors in the 60s, 70s, and mid 80s on how to get rid of certain jurors.
Oh, we heard about those jurors who just happened to be black.
Yeah, and of certain other ethnic groups and religious backgrounds, even educated women. And these aren't my words. These are literally quoted in a U.S. Supreme Court case about this manual. So it wasn't until the mid 80s that the Supreme Court said, you're a resident of Dallas. You have a right to be invited to, you know, participate in the process. So we talked about that because so many people dread getting that summons. But in Dallas specifically, it should be a badge of honor when you get a jury summons because once upon a time you weren't invited to the table.
Right.
So we talk about that and what are your rights if they come to execute a warrant on your house. So a wide range of topics.
Yeah, I think that Supreme Court case may have involved an African-American man. I kind of remember that vaguely, but it was a very incredible case to think that prosecutors were systematically just striking people.
Yes.
And that was a terrible judicial violation. But search warrants, real quickly about search warrants. Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about search warrants? Can anybody just get a search warrant?
No, not anybody.
I mean, does there need to be probable cause for law enforcement?
Yes, that's the standard. There has to be probable cause. And I will tell you that it's something that happens all day long that, you know, law enforcement, things happen, they're generating these, you know, warrants, and they're asking judges to review them to determine if probable cause exists. And then, you know, it gives them access to either a home or a phone or a car, things like that. And so, yes, there is a standard probable cause. But one of the things with the word of mouth session, when we explored this topic, we talked about executing a search warrant at someone's residence. Right. And so we had police officers there that literally walk people from moment one when they arrive at the door all the way to when they leave. And people didn't know that you're entitled to a copy. Mm-hmm. Right. So when they come, they have to give you a copy as well. You can be present, but you can't be in their way. They can move you to one room in your home to make sure that no one, you know, disposes of anything that they're looking for. And so it's just nice to, you know, in this day and age, have a space where police and the public are, you know, learning from each other.
Right.
Because it's important for police to understand the concerns of the public, just like it's important for the public to understand the policies and procedures of the police department. So it was a nice conversation. People walked away and said, you know, God forbid I ever have somebody execute a search warrant on my house, mm-hmm. but I feel like I understand now. And part of it is just access to knowledge. And
yes.
Knowledge is power.
And it seemed like you were way ahead of that situation, that issue, long before the Breonna Taylor no-knock, controversial situation.
Yeah, because this was 2016 that I did that session.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
And as we get ready to wrap up, what do you think about these no-knock warrants, the Breonna, or can you, as a sitting judge, can you even talk about that kind of thing? Because we know that there's a commission on judicial conduct. We don't want to get anybody in trouble.
There is. And, you know, that's the funny thing. It's good to have these conversations, and it's good because a lot goes unsaid by us. And there's a reason why we aren't able to speak on it. So last year with George Floyd and his murder, you know, I couldn't go to Facebook and say what I wanted to say, because as a judge, I'm not able to comment on the law.
For fear you may prejudice the case or something?
Because you are supposed to be fair and impartial regardless of, you know, the circumstances. And so you have to act and carry yourself in a way that gives the public trust that you will do that on the bench.
Yes.
So you're not able to have those conversations. So I have personal opinions. Like I said, I'm one of seven kids. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I have personal opinions as long as the day is.
Yes,
but that's the purpose of the robe as well, right? So when I zip it up, I'm cloaking my personal beliefs.
Beautiful.
And so I can't comment on that.
Sure.
Because, you know, judges have gotten in trouble for saying that they don't agree with things. But I will tell you that it's important for the public to know that it's not that we don't have anything to say.
Mm-hmm.
It's that the oath that we've taken doesn't allow us to express those opinions. But I will tell you this.
Yes.
I can share this with you. I used George Floyd's murder as an example, right? Couldn't go to Facebook. And I know people sometimes are like, why are they silent? Why didn't she say anything? Well, instead of taking to Facebook, what I did do, there were posts, and there was an attorney in Dallas that highlighted the post that were very racist by some attorneys in Dallas. And I didn't comment on the post. Instead, I said, well, what's my duty as a judge here? You know, they're making comments. They get appointments to represent people of all, you know, all the rainbow. And so I need to make sure that they really are protecting everybody's constitutional rights, because these comments on Facebook were, oh, people are animals and subhuman. And so I started doing my research and I realized that out of all the counties in Texas, not one county had an anti-discrimination policy as it relates to attorneys and their behavior. Right. So I said, why not? So I generated an anti-discrimination policy and presented it in 2020. I spoke to the head of the Judicial Ethics Commission. I spoke to the head of the Texas Indigent Defense Commission. And I generated a policy and I've submitted it to my colleagues. And I'm just waiting on some votes to see, you know, will we pass the policy and ensure that these attorneys by word and by conduct aren't doing, saying things that manifest a bias or support hate groups or anything like that. And, you know, instill in the public trust that when we appoint someone, regardless of what the attorney looks like, regardless of what the accused individual looks like, they're going to protect their constitutional rights. So even though I couldn't go to Facebook and say anything, I understand the gravity of my position and the seriousness of it. And I'm the gatekeeper. Right.
Yes, yes.
And so I created that policy and I look forward to implementing it to make sure that if an attorney does post something similar to the things that they posted last year after the murder of George Floyd and the protest, that they are called to the carpet and have to address why they said it, how, you know, it impacts their practice and how they represent people. So even though I can't talk about it, I can create policies that address the matters.
Yes. It'll be interesting to see the reaction from the State Bar Association, whether or not they would support something like that. It'll be interesting.
They did talk about First Amendment rights. And the thing about appointments is that there's no property interest. You don't have a property interest in receiving appointments, right?
Okay.
So the Texas Ethics Commission said it's about appointments. They don't have a property interest in it. You know, there's actually a canon that says that if a judge finds out that an attorney is doing these types of things, it's a wide array of things. But talking about this specific issue, we shall. Didn't say, you know, you can do it if you want to. Didn't say, I'll sleep on it. It says you shall report them to the bar or take other appropriate action. And so this policy is another appropriate action.
Well, we congratulate you, Judge, on being forward thinking in that as well. But as we get ready to wrap up, just a couple of the quick questions. Is there such a thing as judicial activism? And just talk to us about being a member of the AKAs and, of course, your membership there at Concord Church where the Reverend Brian Carter is the pastor.
Yes. Okay, so I think when people see judges doing things that have never been done before, they equate that to judicial, activism. But I don't think so. So somebody might think that my policy is, but you know, there's a judicial canon that requires it of us. So it's just nobody's ever taken the time to address the issue. It's not that I'm radical. It's that because of my life experience, I know that I'm okay with acknowledging that it's an issue that needs to be addressed. I'm not scared to address it. I know it's not a popular thing because we're talking about money. But why would I sit back and be silent and comfortable because it's not me in the position? My job as a judge and the oath that I took means that I'm looking out for everybody, you know? And so there's no way that I could sit silent, know that that was happening, and just post a Facebook comment. Yes. Not only is the Facebook comment inappropriate by way of our canons, but that's not another appropriate action. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's all about making sure that the victims in the cases and those accused are protected.
Okay. Well, it sounds like you're pretty outspoken. Maybe like one of your recently elected Congress people, Cori Bush.
Oh, yes. She's from St. Louis, too. There must be something in the water.
Apparently. And also, you're a member of Concord and you're an AKA?
I am. I am a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, the first and finest. Yes.
Well, any concluding thoughts?
I want people to own the criminal justice system. Don't be a bystander. Whether it's voting because local elections matter, mm-hmm. and the people that are sitting on the benches matter, right? The DA matters, to getting that juror summons and actually coming down to Frank Crowley, to getting the summons for a grand jury, which I'll be impaneling mine on July 9th. I want people to feel like they are a part of the process and they're not subject to the process. Mm-hmm. And so that for me is key, because if you don't like something, you know, you don't have to be a state representative to change the law. You can identify something that needs to be changed and contact your state rep. Yes. And they have people on staff that will generate the language for you. You don't have to know how to write a bill. You know, participate in the process. Be active. Go to Austin. You know, if you don't like what you're seeing in the courtrooms, we're actually following the law that they create in Austin. So yes. Tell them.
My goodness. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking here with Judge Amber Gibbons, once again, the presiding judge of the 282nd Judicial District Court, Felony Court, right here in Dallas, Texas, a very distinguished sister. And of course, you've been listening to the Uplift Network. We're here 24/7. I'm Robert Astley, and we certainly thank you for being with us.